Сочи стартует церемония
Сочи открытия. Сочи начался настоящий спортивный Сочи уже вовсю трудится праздник.
Официальное торжественное открытие.
Тем временем в Сочи настоящий олимпийский
Сочи. Сочи приветствует каждый олимпийский
флаг. Основной состав нашей сборной.
It's here. After years of anticipation, the 2014 Olympic Games in Sochi are finally underway. After a record $50 billion in spending, allegations of corruption and environmental damages, controversies over LGBT rights, and tweets about curious toilets and reports of cameras in the bathroom, the focus presumably will now turn to sports, to what ABC's Wide World of Sports once called the human drama of athletic competition. Except here, of course. Although I've been losing sleep wondering who's going to take home the gold in ice hockey, speed skating, and downhill skiing, I know my esteemed co-host has more weighty matters on his mind. We're still going to talk about the Sochi Games, sort of, but we're going to talk about them as a metaphor. What do they illustrate about Russia? And where it might be going once Vladimir Putin's big party is over. Hello and welcome to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me on the Skype line from Moscow is co-host Mark Galliotti, a professor at New York University, an expert in Russia's security services, and author of the blog In Moscow's Shadows. Welcome, Mark.
Hi there, Brian.
Mark, it's just you and I today, and I know you hate sports, but humor me for a moment. What's the atmosphere there in Moscow now that the games are finally underway? Are people excited and different? What are they talking about when they talk about the games?
Well, we all know that Muscovites are an ebullient people who always wear their heart on their sleeve and greet everyone with a cheery smile and a wave. I mean, I can't say that there's massive amounts of enthusiasm.
Are you in an alternative Moscow?
No, I mean, I think, you know, in fairness, I think there's a certain degree of anticipation. I mean, particularly with the, I mean, we're recording this only a couple of hours before the opening ceremonies.
But the competitions have begun.
Exactly, but I think, you know, there is that sense that's when the big splash starts. It's interesting because obviously if you watch Russian television news, which is clearly, you know, if we're talking about alternative realities, one in and of itself, you don't get any of the sort of the carping and the criticisms that we've seen in the Western media about, mm-hmm. you know, toilets and unfinished facilities.
And cameras instead, and bathrooms.
Yeah, it's all instead, it's about sort of shiny, sparkly new facilities. It's about those international dignitaries that are going, no mention, as it were, of who isn't, and of, you know, plucky young athletes and their medal hopes. And, I mean, I think to an extent that does sort of communicate. But I think that, you know, we've got to put this in context. I remember I was in London on the eve of the London Olympics. And quite frankly, as far as Londoners were concerned, they were more irritated by the building work and the roads closed and such like. In fact, in an opinion poll just before, only 47% of Londoners actually said that they thought that Britain should have bid for the Games in the first place. Once the game starts, once the razzmatazz is in action, once there's gold medal prospects and things, people tend to anyway get caught up in it. So I think at the moment the answer is... despite the wall-to-wall barrage of Sochi propaganda, even sort of every other advert seems to have a Sochi theme. You know, despite that, I don't think sort of Muscovites, at least I can't talk for other Russians, right. Are really, really enthused. But I mean, I imagine that they'll get into the spirit of Putin's big party.
Are you getting the sense that people, even people who are otherwise critical of the games, of the corruption and everything, are getting kind of irritated with the carping that's coming out of the Western media about toilets and such?
Yes.
Not just toilets, but that's kind of become the metaphor for all of this carping.
Hasn't it just? Yes. I mean, I think so. I mean, and you've got to realize that obviously for a large portion of the population, they don't even know about that. If you essentially rely on the Russian media, particularly the sort of mainstream Russian media, you're not really getting that.
Right.
There's some references to sort of, you know, Western carping and so forth, but basically that's kept off the screens and even out of many of the newspapers. But those who do, which obviously tend to be more the as it were, the internet news generation, I think so. I mean, I think that there is this strange and frankly very Russian bipolarity of, on the one hand, a sort of a willingness to castigate their own country, we can't get anything done and so forth. But on the other hand, a sense of irritation when outsiders castigate them, and a sense that, you know, Russia is being held up to a standard that other countries aren't, which we've seen in all kinds of other contexts too.
Right, right. All right, well, to get the ball rolling to talk about Sochi as metaphor, I wanted to play just a couple of clips. Here's President Vladimir Putin addressing the Russian Olympic team this week. Let's listen to what President Putin had to say.
Russia has been preparing for this moment for 7 years. This has become a big nationwide project. I'm especially pleased to note that, as they say in such cases, we had a complete national consensus regarding holding these Olympic Games.
Complete national consensus. Well, here's Lev Gudkov, director of the Independent Levada Center, discussing a poll on Russians' actual attitudes toward the Olympics. Let's listen to Mr. Gudkov.
Russians' attitude to the Olympics is quite far away from the unanimous enthusiasm and excitement which can be seen on our television. On the one hand, many Russians consider this costly and pompous venture as a kind of royal ballet, a self-promotion by an authoritarian regime seeking to revive the style of the Soviet Union as a great empire.
Well, quite a contrast there between Putin and Lev Gudkov. And this gets to something I wanted to discuss. I'm fond of saying on this podcast and writing on the blog that Putin wants to party like it's 2007. This was the year, you could argue, he was at the height of his power. This was also the year Sochi was awarded the Olympics, incidentally. And at that time, there most likely was a national consensus about holding the Games. Today, according to the Levada poll, just 23% of Russians believe that the Olympics are important and will help national consolidation. Holding the Games are in Russia are important and will help national consolidation. Does this illustrate how much Russia's changed in the 7 years since it's been awarded the Games?
Yeah, and I think it's changed along two axes. But just first, let me just throw actually another data point from that Levada poll. I mean, it's one thing to say, you know, whether or not you think it's going to be important or whatever. But, I mean, more broadly, I mean, the Levada poll found 53% of Russians happy that Russia was holding the Olympics. Which in some ways is the most capacious, because, you know, you can be happy that it's being held even if you don't really think it's going to be a big deal.
Right.
So, the 53% is the high point.
Mm-hmm.
And again, I mean, I think that contrasts particularly well with Putin's allegations that there's this sort of, as they say, national consensus.
Right.
You know, it clearly isn't. Yeah, I mean, I think that what Sochi throws up in this case is precisely how Russia has changed along, as I said, two axes. One is the, as it were, the objective conditions. That in 07, there was plenty of money. They could afford to burn, if need be, $50 billion on a boondoggle like this. I'm not saying without noticing it, but nonetheless, you know, the budget could hold that. There is no way that this, and okay, we don't know the exact figure, but there's no way that Sochi is not eating into other funds and eating into other capacity-building projects that really should be far, far more important. 07, the North Caucasus was much less of a challenge than it is now. So, you know, for all kinds of reasons, the country definitely has changed. The country that could afford it now is more questionable. But I think the second way in which Russia has changed is precisely about how Russians feel about their government and feel about their country, and if it, you know, without getting too touchy-feely, feeling about themselves. That the buoyant confidence of 2007, which was both cause and effect of Putin's high opinion polls, has clearly been eroded dramatically. Russians are going through a period in which they're not quite sure, you know, where they are. It's one of the reasons why nationalism is, you know, an increasing factor. And I think at this point, what was clearly meant to be a rallying point for the country instead is actually posing questions. Should we be playing big boys games of this sort? Should we be spending money on these kind of, you know, great big national sort of theme park events? In many ways, these are the kind of questions that the UK went through, another post-imperial power that still hasn't really managed to sort of get its head around the fact that it no longer rules half the world. But on the other hand, obviously Britain was in a much stronger position, could afford it more, and that kind of thing. So, I mean, I think it's both Russians as people and Russia as a country that has changed.
Now, another Levada poll shows Putin's popularity reaching almost 2007 heights of late. He's up into the high 60s. Do you attribute this to the wall-to-wall coverage of the Olympic preparation? What do you attribute that to? Because that kind of took me for a loop a little bit.
I think it's two things. I mean, one is, yes, that I think there's an inevitable sort of degree of a Sochi bump. Even if people don't actually have a great enthusiasm for Sochi, just simply, you know, this is an excuse for a lot of Putin coverage, and it's a very kind of classic Putin theme. It's sporty, it's international, it's a big project and such like. I think the second reason is, you know, I mean, and you know, something that we've talked about in previous podcasts is that, you know, the approval figures for Putin are not the same as approval figures for Western politicians, exactly, in which they're contested ones. I mean, I think it also reflects that this has been a period in which, as we spoke about last week, that the opposition hasn't really been in evidence. There hasn't really been the kind of themes around which opposition can cohere. And therefore, inevitably, when there is only one guy in the frame, in the absence of anything bringing down opinion polling, you'd expect a slow drift upwards to that natural sort of two-thirds-ish kind of figure.
Yeah, but I would argue that when his numbers are in the low 50s or the high 40s, which they were for a little while there, that's dangerous if you want to rule like Putin. You have to now he's getting his numbers up. Even in this uncontested way that you have to look at polls of Russian leaders now, his numbers are getting up into the territory where he's kind of safe to rule like Putin again, no?
Well, but let me throw out another one, which came in this, another figure that came in the same poll. Now, I can't remember the exact figure, but certainly there was, I think it was high 40s or whatever, but certainly more than the remaining 30-something percent, who said that they felt that Russia was heading in the wrong direction.
Mm-hmm.
So you have the sort of bizarre spectacle of there must have been some people who approve of Putin and yet feel that Russia is going in the wrong direction.
Right.
Now, okay, one could say that's because they think that at least he's holding it back, so it's kind of going in the wrong direction more slowly or whatever. But I do think it speaks to this actual brittleness of these numbers, that you can approve of a guy because you think that he's still an effective figure and you know about him and who else is there. But generally speaking, you have almost half the Russian population willing to say that they think their country is going in the wrong direction. That, for me, is just as important a data point.
The problem is
that you might say Putin might think, because he's got those high approval figures, he can rule like it's 2007. But I just think that in that case, he is fooling himself, not for the first time.
So, yeah, and again, one of the things we're going to get into in this discussion is, you know, what happens after Sochi, because but we'll get to that a little bit later. I wanted to go down a bunch of things looking at this as, you know, Sochi as metaphor, and you and I kind of off mic batted some of these things around in preparation for this podcast. One of them's corruption. There's been a lot of talk about that at least half the budget's been siphoned away to one place or another. I want to play a couple of clips because to keeping with this theme of like what Russian officials are saying and what others who have been watching the situation are saying. Let's listen to Dmitry Kozak, Deputy Prime Minister Dmitry Kozak, the official in charge of the Olympics. Let's listen to what he had to say about corruption.
The facts of corruption, theft, and waste have to be proven by the courts. I can assure you that such a task was given to the law enforcement and oversight agencies from the very beginning. The oversight has been unprecedented.
That may or may not be the case, but I'm just find it hard to believe that the courts and the law enforcement in the power vertical, Putin's power vertical, are interested in serious oversight. Now let's listen to the Kremlin's favorite gadfly, Alexei Navalny, anti-corruption blogger and opposition leader. Let's listen to what he had to say after presenting his own report, his own very detailed report on corruption in Sochi, which he published online last month. Let's listen to Mr. Navalny.
From the outset, the entire Sochi project was conceived in a way that would not only produce the Olympic Games, but would also enrich a small circle of Putin's close friends. We conducted a thorough assessment of 11 Olympic construction projects of the approximate value of almost $14 billion, and we discovered that the value was overstated by some $5.5 billion in a completely unjustified and corrupt way. Therefore, if we apply this ratio to all of the projects, we can say that the 30% figure, named by many analysts and critics as the amount of stolen money, is not far from the truth.
Illusion and reality? Mark, what do you make of the contrast between those two statements?
Yes, well, I mean, if the law enforcement agencies are assiduously investigating corruption, then that suggests that they are astonishingly bad at their job. I mean, that said, I mean, with taking Navalny's, as I said, very sort of comprehensive and glossily presented survey, I mean, there are always problems. We can't really double check his data. Universalizing on the basis of a sample doesn't always give you an accurate result. But, you know, this kind of carping aside, you know, all that means is that we're haggling over the exact figure. But it is clear that there's been a massive level of corruption within this project, and it's not surprising because, you know, all these mega projects tend to lead to opportunities for high level corruption, because it's not so much the, you know, small scale grifting, it's precisely the sort of strategic level, the industrial scale embezzlement that tends to sort of emerge. And I mean, in a way, what else can COSAC possibly say? Actually taking on the figures who are unlikely to have been involved in the corruption, well, that's above his pay grade. That's a decision that has to be made by one man and one man alone. So, of course, he's going to say that everything is wonderful. And I'd be surprised if people believe him. Again, I think people might question the scale of embezzlement, but I think, you know, as we heard from Gudkov, you know, there is a general assumption within Russia that where there's money being spent, there's money being stolen.
Right. And it's interesting that you make that distinction between the small scale grifting and the industrial. I like the way you put that, the industrial scale corruption, because doesn't Sochi kind of illustrate this? That the industrial scale corruption is okay, but the small scale grifting, do you expect some symbolic case after the Olympics to maybe put this issue to rest, and, you know, they'll arrest some minor figure for some small scale grifting and not pay any attention and think that will brush the industrial scale corruption under the carpet, maybe?
I mean, it could well be. It's difficult to know, because there's a part of me that almost thinks, well, on the one hand, that might sort of allow them to say, look, you know, we dealt with this, and this person who stole, you know, $2 million, that was the corruption, and we caught him. But on the other hand, then you have the issue of, firstly, it does sort of at least provide a little bit of rain on the parade, even if after the event. And secondly, it unpicks a whole variety of issues. I mean, I think, you know, if they found someone who, as it were, has broken the rules in classic Russian sense, has stolen more than he's entitled to steal, then fair enough. But in some ways, one would have thought actually the time to have done that would have been
before the Olympics.
Precisely. You know, a month ago would have been the ideal time to say, you know, we're dealing with this. But you know, the Russians tend not to be masters of PR in this kind of respect. So, I mean, I think there is a chance. But again, because I suspect, and it's hard really to tell for certain, but I suspect there's very little scope for, you know, except on the very, very petty level, individual enterprise corruption.
Right.
You know, if you're taking, you know, skimming money, it's because you're part of a big, you know, a big structure that is skimming money. You know, and therefore, whether or not it's actually going to make sense to try and unpick it and pick a few people, we'll wait and see.
I guess what I'm trying, what I'm hoping to drive at here is, how much is the corruption in Sochi a metaphor for the corruption of the way the Russian state operates in general? Do you see a kind of a a parallel there? Or is this a special case because it's such a mega project?
No, I mean, in some ways one can look at, I mean, I know we're going to talk a bit more about mega projects
in a second. Yeah,
a few minutes.
I'm segueing.
But in some ways, I mean, actually, mega projects is precisely how the Putin system works as much as anything else. And I really do think this is a metaphor for, you know, late model Putinism. That if you are a trusted member of the court or useful, you can make a hell of a lot of money. In some ways, this is Putin's answer to loans for shares.
Mm-hmm.
That particularly miserable experience in which basically sort of Yeltsin bought political coverage from the oligarchs by allowing them to just sort of, you know,
buy the crown jewels of the
economy
for a pittance. Yeah.
Well, I mean, in a way, sort of what Putin is doing now is not being willing to allow people to sort of take industries, but instead skim from massive government projects. Now, I think the interesting thing is that what I don't know is if this is a metaphor that really damages Putin as much as it might. I mean, we're back to almost that maybe apocryphal Stalin comment that, you know, one person's death is a tragedy, as a million is a statistic.
Right.
Well, likewise, I mean, in the sense of individuals get outraged when the traffic cop,
right,
you know, invents an offense and wants a few hundred rubles from them. But, you know, some guy has stolen a billion rubles.
Right.
That's just so stratospheric that it's almost in a separate world,
mm-hmm,
or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it is a metaphor for how we understand Putinism, but surprisingly enough, it's not a metaphor that is as damaging to Putin as one would have thought.
It would be a great journalistic project to look at, like, what kind of needs does Russia have in terms of its infrastructure, and if you can get a reliable figure on how much money's been pilfered, or the figure that's been spent on the games for that matter, what you could have built for what it took to hold the Olympics.
Absolutely.
But again, still, that would probably be kind of abstract in the minds of the average man and woman. But going back to the original point of our, where we said, you know, Putin wants to party like it's 2007, I think this isn't just a metaphor for late Putinism. This is a metaphor for Putinism. And it's operating in late Putinism. And you very succinctly spelled out how the country has changed since then. Is this going to come back to bite them in this new environment? Because it's almost like, yeah, this mega project's a metaphor for Putinism, but this in this case, it's a mega project that's 7 years past its sell-by date. So do you think in this new environment this is a little bit more dangerous?
Oh, much more dangerous, because precisely there isn't the money. In early Putinism, thanks to global hydrocarbon prices, the national cake was just constantly expanding.
Right.
So really the only discussion was, how much bigger a slice do you have? And that also meant there was enough cake and icing to also buy off the masses.
A critical mass of them, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And in that respect, it's actually like early Brezhnevism.
Mm-hmm.
Good times, and okay, so people who are powerful have especially good times, but there was enough trickling down to everyone to keep everyone happy. But the point is, now that the cake is really not expanding at all, but demands and hunger and expectations are still there, people have got used to getting more. And in some ways, one could say that it looks like actually the levels of corruption on that kind of, you know, whereas ironically, I get the sense that ordinary people are facing corruption less often in their lives.
It's interesting.
But on the other hand, the embezzlement at the top of the system actually seems to be increasing. Well, that money has to come from somewhere.
Yeah.
And it's an interesting parallel. I mean, I was wrong in, I thought about 2 years ago that Putin had finally got his head round the extent to which embezzlement within the military procurement budget was affecting something that actually counted in his world, i.e. the capacity to field shiny new tanks and planes and everything else. Because time and again, the chief military prosecutor was warning about the sort of extraordinary levels of corruption. Everyone knew about it. Rogozin was talking about it, etc. And there seemed to be signs that actually maybe something was going to be done about it, because precisely that was a clear case in which corruption was eating into something that matters to Putin. Putin doesn't really care in the grand scheme of things if there's natural gas being piped to villages out in the middle of the Urals, but he does care about the tanks. But even that they failed to do anything about. And the whole Serdyukov case really emphasizes that. So either there is an unwillingness or there is an inability to actually do something about this corruption that is increasingly bleeding the state.
Why do you think nothing was done about the military procurement corruption?
I think, again, it's just too complex and too many moving parts. You know, it would have meant running up against a whole variety of interests. A lot of the embezzlement takes place within the defense industrial complex, which is, after all, one of the kind of political bases of Putin's power. And we come down to, again this strange timidity in the heart of tough guy Putin, that he's not one to take risks. Mm-hmm. And I think to actually sort of attack an element of the elite, which is both politically strong and essentially usually supportive of him, I just think it was a risk that he backed away from.
Mm. Well, let's talk a little bit about these mega projects. What I call the meta project fetish. Cost be damned, be it monetary, human, or environmental, and the big show fetish. Cost be damned, be it monetary, human, or environmental, or otherwise. What does this show us?
I think what it shows us is, again, the extent to which this has become the governance of the court. It's very hard for one person to manage a modern, complex, bureaucratic state. So many things going on, so many moving parts, and therefore to that extent, actually most, sort of, you know, whether it's a president or a prime minister, they are chief executives with strikingly little power in most things. It's civil services that actually go and do most of what happens. Well, in Russia, we still have a civil service that is in many ways, I mean, not entirely, but you know, in many ways, politicized, doesn't have the capacity to do that or isn't trusted to do that. Putin likes to be in charge. And it's a lot easier to go for some big, big projects than to talk about, you know, the tedious kind of nuts and bolts of the sort of things that Kudrin was urging him to do when he was still being listened to, about reforming the whole governance structure of the Russian state. You know, that's difficult. It's complex. It's tedious. There's no drama in it. You don't get a chance to hobnob with world potentates, to helicopter in, to launch some sort of massive glitzy opening event or whatever. You know, whoever has a launch party for bureaucratic regulations? So, I mean, I think reason number one is just the way Putin likes to run things. Reason number two is precisely that actually mega projects provide you with a great opportunity for directed gift giving to members of the elite. That it suddenly is, you know, we've suddenly pulled together this project, which means there's this great big cauldron of cash, and we will now be dispensing that cash. So anyway, it requires people to once again reaffirm their loyalty. It forces people to show where, you know, allows people to see where they are in the chain of, you know, Putin's cronies and such like. Again, in a way that routine day-to-day government activities don't allow the same dispensation of opportunities. So I mean, I think it's both Putin's personality and the practical needs of a system that is built around regularly forcing people to reassert their loyalty to the crown, and the crown in due course providing them with goodies as a result.
Now let's bring this back to this recurring retro theme we keep going back to about partying like it's 2007. But this again was a feature of early Putinism. Remember the national projects that who was in charge of those? Medvedev, if I remember correctly, back in Putin's first stint in the Kremlin. Again, is this something that's outlived its usefulness? We've talked about how society's changed, and looking at the Levada poll, society doesn't seem to be responding to this mega project, which is the mother of all mega projects, which, you know, in terms of bread and circuses. Is this another sign that Russian society is evolving and is outgrowing this type of regime?
Well, I'll be honest, I'm not sure if, as it were, the mega project approach ever really was a good thing. I mean, I'm thinking also going back to the Baikal Amur Magistral and you know, further back, you know, Soviet leaders likewise.
Or the Big Show. I mean, the mega project and the Big Show. They're two related kind of somewhat overlapping phenomenon.
To talk about the mega projects first, I mean, I appreciate that they do overlap. Again, I think that the thing was more in the early Putin days. They may not be an efficient way of running the show, but the point is they were affordable.
Mm-hmm.
You can afford a lot of stupidity when you've got lots of money, in a way that you can't when the money starts running out. But secondly, I think there's also the point of, well, okay, mega projects may not be particularly efficient or useful ways. They certainly don't. They actually militate against you reforming your basic sort of government structure. But on the other hand, I mean, if they're well chosen. I mean, let's take Skolkovo, the sort of the high tech development that was meant to emerge, and again, it seems to be running into the ground. Theoretically, Skolkovo was actually a really quite good idea.
Yeah, it was. I thought so.
You know, so mega projects can conceivably be useful. The problem was precisely, I mean, the things that made Skolkovo a good idea also made them much more complex and hard to just simply, you can't just throw cash at it and hope that something happens. So instead, we've moved from mega projects which could have some really meaningful political or above all economic impact to precisely mega projects for show. Sochi is going to have a few legacy benefits, but not really that many.
Nothing like Skolkovo would have had it worked out.
Absolutely. Likewise, all the development that went on in Vladivostok for the APEC summit, that was one of the, you know,
another one of the big
projects. Again, did it have some value for Vladivostok and the maritime region? Yes, but did it provide bang for buck compared to the amount spent? Absolutely not. Third example, Kazan, the city of Kazan, the capital of Tatarstan, that was chosen to host the Universiade, sort of student sporting games, which, you know, together sort of bring all my bête noires together into one thing. You know, again, did Kazan need some development? Certainly, like most provincial capitals. But on the other hand, did most of that money end up not being spent on things that are going to provide proper
legacy? Kazan, the reports, at least coming out of Kazan, were that there was a remarkably low, there was corruption, but remarkably low compared to most of these Russian mega projects, were some of the reports I had read. But that said, your point's taken.
Yeah, I mean, I think Kazan was relatively sort of, again, relatively, excepting that part, you know, efficient and, you know, suffered from a lower level of embezzlement, and in part precisely because it was in Kazan. It wasn't in one of the kind of the politically prestigious areas, and I think that therefore more of the work ended up being handed to locals who actually had a reason to do the work, rather than anything else. But so, I mean, I think come back to, it's definitely the mega project is increasingly just about the circus and just about the politics and the dispensation of money. Whereas once upon a time, yes, the mega project was a wasteful way of doing it, but could also potentially be something that actually could develop the country too.
What about the show? What about the big show fetish, which is related but not entirely overlapping with the mega projects? But the Olympics are a big show, and I couldn't help but keep going back to this 2007 thing. But remember the Putin national leader rallies that were going on back in 2007 in Tver. In other places, and all this hysteria that was whipped up right towards the end of Putin's term. Again, has this society outgrown this kind of spectacle?
Look, everyone loves a party. No one loves a hangover. I mean, I think the importance of holding a party, it certainly has value. But the point is, if there's nothing underpinning it, I mean, if a party is there to celebrate and remind people of good stuff, it has a long-term value, because it's not just about the party. It's also about the fact that that party got you thinking, good Lord, yes, I forgot how, you know, respected we are in the world or whatever. And that's what carries support through. A party that's just for the sake of a party, you know, maybe a week, a month, it has importance. It very soon becomes a, oh, do you remember that? Yeah. You know, it, I'm, I, I haven't seen any real evidence that these kind of events in and of themselves, not just in Russia, but generally, actually have any kind of a long-term thing. It's a real, you know, $50 billion to buy yourself a, you know, 1 month bump in approval ratings is definitely not good value.
Now, you mentioned earlier how this whole mega project fetish reminds you of early Brezhnevism. It's interesting. What I immediately thought of at that point was that the last time Russia held the Olympics was 1980, which was getting pretty close to late Brezhnevism. It wasn't completely the end yet, but it was getting there. So it was right at the end. And that got me thinking, again, these metaphors we keep coming back to, are we in late Brezhnevism with Putin? But we've done that a billion times. But what happens after Sochi? What happens after Putin's big party's over? What's the hangover going to be like? Is there going to be a hangover?
Well, let's assume that nothing goes wrong. I mean, clearly, you know, all bets are off if something disastrous. But let's get the best case scenario. So you know, the events work out. The facilities are, you know, okay. There's a good crop of medals sufficient to assuage national pride, etc. Okay. And yeah, I mean, I think afterwards, then people will be feeling sort of pleased with themselves, pleased with their country, and obviously Putin will gain the benefit from that. Now, I don't think there's likely to be a direct carryover in the sense of, I don't think it's sort of in, you know, a month later people will suddenly blink and say, but hang on a minute, it cost 50 billion, that wasn't worth it for that. But I think first of all, that 50 billion came from somewhere. And I think, in a way, the impact will be felt as people increasingly notice a discrepancy between how they feel their lives ought to be and how their lives really are. It's 50 billion precisely that's not fixing roads and not spreading gas mains and whatever else. You know, we're seeing, for example, across-the-board cuts being applied to the various, you know, government ministries.
Mm-hmm.
You know, these things all begin to cut. And you know, people may not connect A and B, the big Sochi party, with the fact that their salary has been frozen or whatever. But the point is, whatever the reason, they're going to be annoyed because their salary is frozen.
Mm.
So, I mean, I think that's hangover number one. Hangover number two is, likewise, when you have a system that relies on buying people off, well, people expect to continue to be bought off. You know, no one is going to say, well, that's fair enough. You know, we made a lot of money off Sochi. You know, fair dues. You know, we ought to be loyal for a few years now. No, it's always, okay, well, that was nice, but what's coming next? And I think this, for me, is also one of the particular problems. When you have a national leadership that seems, at the moment at least, bereft of any sort of inspirations about structural reform of its own system, doesn't really have much of an idea about how to connect with its own people, except through the medium of big staged events like this. You know, what might they be tempted to do next? I mean, we've got the World Cup coming up, obviously, right. But that's in a few years' time. You know, there's some years between now and then. I mean, are we going to have some new grand initiative or whatever? Again, I think in this respect, big mega projects, big national initiatives, essentially are substitutes for substantive, meaningful change and a willingness to accept the real challenges facing the system. Mm-hmm. So again, I mean, you know, it's not that there's going to be a direct connection,
mm-hmm.
but I think actually, you know, Sochi leads us towards what I think are the real challenges for the Kremlin after the party.
Right, and after the party, we're heading into a political season, don't forget. We're heading
Absolutely.
Into a political season. Moscow Duma elections in October. There's going to be just like 8 months, you know, 8 months is nothing in politics, right? The campaign for the Moscow Duma, which is going to be a nationalized affair in a lot of ways. I mean, Moscovites are going to be voting, but the whole country is going to be watching, just like they were for the Moscow mayoral elections. Navalny's not going to shut up about the Olympic, but his allegations of Olympic corruption. And do you see a danger that people will draw the contrast? You said earlier, I thought there's a very good point. You said, you know, they don't want to do these mundane things about reforming the government and reforming spending, things that people like Kujan were telling them they need to do. But when I hear from the more thoughtful voices in the opposition in the street, this is what a significant part of the population wants them to do, to dispense of these mega projects. So is there a danger that people are going to start demanding that and they will be beginning to draw the contrast there between what they really need to be doing and they're trying to pull the wool over our eyes with bread and circuses?
I don't think that's something that will organically bubble up. But on the other hand, I think it is an absolute opportunity for Navalny and other opposition figures. I mean, he's already come up, as it were, with his macro scale sense of what the Sochi corruption is. You know, this 30% figure, mm-hmm. whatever. And again, I mean, I think that's something that really appeals to outsiders. It's interesting for people who are already, you know, internet savvy, skeptical of the government. In some ways, that therefore, I don't think is going to have a major impact in and of itself. But it's the first stage. What he then has to do, and you know, he and his people, is then precisely be able to connect that with grassroots concerns. You know, if he can establish it in people's minds that Sochi was corrupt, and that massive amounts of money were spent on Sochi, wasted on Sochi, then when he goes and campaigns in the streets and says, look, you know. This area, this Pirikhod, this underpass was meant to be fixed, and you can see that even though the repair crews have been through, half the lights still don't work. You know, little boring things like that. If he can connect things that make an impact on people's real lives and say, and why is that? Well, it's because the municipal repairs budget has been cut by 8%, and that's because its subvention from federal funds has been cut. Why? Well, you know, they just wasted X amount on, you know, X billion on Sochi. That's one of, I think, the real potentials he's got. It's all very well just simply saying, you know, not everyone's lives are wonderful. There are things you'd like to be done. Everyone knows that. But if he can actually then say, and part of, or maybe the reason why that hasn't happened, mm-hmm. is because Putin wanted to have his party, and he wanted his friends to have one hell of a goodie bag when they left, well, that might actually have some resonance. That's what we've been waiting for, mm-hmm. honestly, in terms of the next stage development of the opposition. It's a much sharper willingness to connect the big picture stuff that Navalny does so well and is so interested in with the small granular scale stuff that most voters are really thinking about. And, you know, in some ways, Sochi has given him another chance mm-hmm. to do that.
And he also, I would argue, demonstrated an ability to do that during the Moscow mayoral elections. If he could build on that's another question. But go ahead.
Yeah, no, exactly. But I think, you know, this is a nice specific thing. I mean, he talked about corruption. This is actually gives him a very, very sharply focusing. It's not just mm-hmm. corruption as a big systemic thing. It's Sochi, mm-hmm. which precisely the reason why Putin gets a bump from Sochi is because everyone regards it as a Putin project, rightly. Well, the other edge of that sword is that if Navalny can start painting Sochi as a liability, that also begins to apply to Putin
as well. Yeah. Well, it promises to be a hell of a party and a pretty interesting hangover, and we'll be keeping our eye on it. In a few moments, we will shift gears away from Sochi and look at the Kremlin's ramped up efforts to rein in Russia's new media landscape. I'd like to remind you are listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me on the Skype line from Moscow is co-host Mark Galeotti, a professor at New York University, an expert in Russia's security services, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. I'd also like to remind you can subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You could read the Power Vertical blog at rferl.org, and you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical.
Grounds for restricting access to the internet are disseminating information containing incitement to unrest,
extremist activities, and participation in mass public events that are organized in violation of the established order.
The Kremlin is late to the new media party. Speaking of parties. Obsessed with controlling traditional broadcast media, it snoozed as vibrant new communities, networks, and outlets sprung up online. But with internet penetration now at 59% in Russia, according to some estimates, they have clearly woken up to the fact that they're losing control of a key source of information and are in danger of losing control of the narrative. And they're acting. There were new laws passed in December that made it easier to for prosecutors to block websites deemed extremist, even without a court order, and for criminal penalties for promoting separatism online. Pavel Durov, the iconoclastic CEO of Kontakte, was made an offer he can't refuse, and this month sold his remaining shares in the popular social networking site, ending an era at Russia's alternative to Facebook. And in recent weeks, cable and satellite operators dropped Dosh TV from its packages, reportedly under pressure, effectively forcing a key alternative media outlet from the airwaves. Mark, there's two ways to look at this. Either the Kremlin is playing a losing game of whack-a-mole, or, on the other hand, the power vertical, his power vertical, not mine, is about to crush the power horizontal. In the blog this week, I argued for the futile whack-a-mole scenario. Feel free to shoot down my optimism.
Well, I mean, I appreciate that my role in these podcasts is usually to shoot down your optimism. I think I would... I'll give you partial agreement in the sense of I think I would want to disaggregate two separate elements. The Dosh TV issue from the social media one.
Mm-hmm.
TV, I mean, you know, and Dosh TV as a cable TV channel is something that the state can and has acted against. Because it is clear that television is, you know, genuinely regarded as the most powerful medium at the moment for disseminating the Kremlin's perspective on the world. And it does a sort of a powerful job of doing that. And one of the interesting things of actually being here and being able to sort of tune in on various TV channels, it's quite fascinating to get a sense of what the world of Russian television really is. And therefore, I think they're perhaps rather sort of badly timed, but nonetheless effective sort of campaign against Dosh TV. It says something about the extent to which the Kremlin can actually squeeze out alternative voices on television. Now, the whack-a-mole dimension comes in the sense of precisely that although we're still a fair way away from TV being anything other than the biggest contributor to the sort of national perceptions, but nonetheless, I mean, I think it is clear that as Russia bit by bit moves into the internet age, the Kremlin is not going to be able to do the same sort of things, despite whatever powers, controls, and such like it manages. The best it can hope to do is, in a way, and we're back to sort of the early days of Radio Liberty, is jam the signal.
Right.
By which I don't mean actually.
I almost explicitly used that metaphor on my blog, and I decided against it at the last moment.
Well, you see, I don't have to worry about whether I'm sort of advertising
promoting yourself,
promoting your old intention.
No, so thank I you mean, for no, doing what I decided not to do out of.
I mean, you know, through trolls, through all kinds of sort of, you know, patriotic hackers, through setting up or, you know, sites sort of presenting their own perspective, even while looking as if they're informal, non-government ones or whatever. What the Russian government can do is to try and ensure that the sort of the signals coming through in the internet are terribly confusing. And what that will tend to mean is that actually people will in a way gravitate towards the sources that say the things that they anyway believe.
Mm-hmm.
If you believe that, you know, the Kremlin is corrupt, you will go to certain sources. If you believe that the system is essentially whole and you're facing Western propaganda campaigns and destabilization, you will go to other internet
but you
sources.
you don't totally control the narrative in that environment.
Well, have to
share with other narratives.
Absolutely, and the interesting thing is that, you know, and in some ways one can almost draw the parallel of the U.S. Republican Party's flirtation with the Tea Party movement. Of it suddenly thinking, wow, here's this dynamic, yes, extreme, but nonetheless sort of powerful and energetic force that we think we can co-opt. And then a little way down the line thinking, eek, actually this beast is now co-opting us and it's constraining our opportunities and basically it wants to push us in a direction which will essentially make us unelectable. So, you know, the rotund old men in expensive suits who thought that they could take control of this new medium suddenly found themselves outflanked in that respect. We might well find a very similar situation, in Russia. It's precisely that, and again, this is something that you talked about in your blog post, is precisely that actually what might here and now seem like a useful tool against it, which will try and counter the voices you want countered, increasingly constrains you. For example, and the classic thing is, you know, Putin has always tried to maintain this delicate balance of state nationalism without going into ethnic Russian nationalism and anti-Semitism and all these other rather toxic sort of, you know, ingredients we've sometimes seen of the right in Russia. Well, that's a subtlety that is frankly probably lost amidst most of these kind of voices that otherwise would seem to be natural allies of the Kremlin against the Navalny's of this world. Right. So, yeah, I mean, I think sort of putting aside the television angle, where basically, you know, as long as you can start creating a situation in which, you know, cable channels drop a particular sort of, you know, station, you can actually control that. Once you move into the internet realm, I think that the Kremlin, you know, is kidding itself if it thinks it can essentially control the narratives that are going to emerge.
Well, I would argue that it's even kidding itself on the TV angle. And the reason being is that television and the internet are basically merging, pretty much. You could still watch Dosht online. And the, like I said, 59% internet penetration in Russia. That's not Moscow. That's Russia. Also, I read this week that Dosht is looking into deals with Apple TV, where Russia has no power to stop it, right? It's basically something you download and beam to your TV via a little box. It's how I watch most of my favorite American serials, by the way, you know, like Mad Men, which I never managed to get a reference from that show into this podcast. But so even with TV, over time, when terrestrial broadcast is going to be retro, but even cable and satellite is going to become retro. It's going to become the internet. The internet is going to become the platform for media. And if that, when we get to that point, then they're even going to lose control of the TV part of it.
Well, the question is how long?
Yeah.
It's going to move more slowly. The kind of people who are, you know, streaming TV, and also, let's face it, this being Russia, sort of pirating vast amounts of things as well. Are probably largely already the generation that, I hesitate to say Putin has lost, but are less inclined to be Putin's natural constituency. But I think it's going to take a while. I mean, my concern is, you know, if we're talking about whack-a-mole, you know, there's this notion of, well, how do you respond? There is precisely that kind of bespoke approach that you don't like what Vkontakte is doing, so you hit Vkontakte, and as you said, and then some new startup comes up with some brand new platform doing exactly the same. Or you take the Chinese route.
Right.
And you start working out, well, okay, you know, how can we basically secede from the world telecommunications revolution? How can we precisely control? You know, you could, for example, block Apple TV.
You could. And somebody would set up a proxy server that would allow you to get it anyway. I mean, and this is another point
But it becomes hard. I mean, you know.
It becomes harder, yeah.
I think, for most people will follow the line of least resistance. If you're going to have to sort of every week change your proxy server and run the risk that someone's going to sort of also download a virus, or that you're going to get a fine because they see that you're doing something illegal or whatever, people may well not do so. But either way, I mean, I think the point is we have to think about, well, what are the horizons? I'm increasingly feeling that, regardless of how long Putin actually remains in office, and as I said, I'm not convinced that he's going to stand for election again. But even putting that aside, I don't get the sense that this current government, this current regime, is thinking long term. Mm. I think they are lurching from moment to moment, month to month. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying that they yet think, God, it's a matter of survival, but I'm struck by the absence of any serious strategy for the long term. And that doesn't matter if we're talking about, you know, important but undramatic things like pension reform or infrastructure investment, or even just sort of, you know, wider issues of basically how they will try and create a long-term political platform and narrative. You know, United Russia is a joke. There is really, I mean, this is the irony. Navalny has not yet been able to create any kind of party structure. The Kremlin has basically allowed its party structure to decay and become in some ways a joke and in other ways an irrelevance. Who is thinking more than 6 months, 12 months out? You know, you're talking about a process that'll play out, even at the accelerating speed of technology, minimum 5 years.
Mm-hmm. And you don't think they got that long anyway.
I don't think they got that long anyway, but I don't even think that they're thinking in terms of a 5 year. You know, at least the Soviets thought in terms of 5 year plans.
Yeah, yeah.
I almost feel that Putin were onto 5 month plans.
Well, and before we wrap up, one other thing I wanted to touch on is along these lines is like, and you described this very well, that this kind of natural pluralism is going to develop in the media space as it develops over time, even with the Kremlin trying to play whack-a-mole or going the Chinese route. I still think you're going to have some natural pluralism out there. And that natural pluralism is that eventually one would think is going to translate into the political system, no?
I very much think so. I mean, obviously, it'll be particularly significant on a, you know, smaller scale level, such as, oh gosh, Moscow local elections. Mm-hmm. But I think again, what it really speaks to is that what we're going to see is coalition building, and I don't necessarily mean that in a formal sense of multiple parties getting together and sort of agreeing things, but precisely people managing to craft messages that can apply to a whole different range. I mean, almost as a again, if we're talking about metaphors. When I walk my dog down Novokuznetska, I pass graffiti that says Russia for the Russians. I pass graffiti that says something entirely unmentionable on a sedate podcast like this about the police. I pass graffiti that clearly is poking fun at the kind of United Russia and so forth. And I pass posters, you know, remnants of the mayoral election posters. Mm-hmm. All of which are for, you know, insurgent candidates. I haven't seen none are for Sobyanin, and all of them are basically emphasizing change. Now, the irony is that, as it were, the people who did this graffiti and these posters are very, very different in terms of what they want. But actually, someone like Navalny or Navalny himself could easily craft a narrative that actually unites them all.
I think he is trying to.
Precisely. And I think this is it. It's building these messages that allow the organic creation of coalitions in the absence of any kind of party structure. And that is also going to be visible in the infosphere. Mm-hmm. Precisely, you know, you will have this bizarre situation in which, you know, 20-something liberal cosmopolitans and rabid nationalist frothing haters of every other ethnicity and anti-Semites, and also kind of, you know, rational economics, you know, sort of professors who see that which direction the economy is going, can all find themselves supporting the same candidate online, mm-hmm. just as they can in the ballot box.
Well, yeah, and it's no accident. I began the blog post on this topic about a nationalist website that also was posting, as I put it in the blog, something that would warm the hearts of liberals, libertarians, and anarchists. Online how-to manuals of how to access websites that are blocked, and online do's and don't lists of what to do with the FSB's listening to your phone and how to get around that. So I thought that illustrated the whole thing rather nicely. Any last words before we wrap up?
I think that, again, if we want to link this back to Sochi, the thing about Sochi is, like any big event, you know, it becomes everyone's metaphor. And again, as we see an exploding pluralism, of perspectives being available online. Whether it's Sochi, whether it's what's going on in Chechnya and the Caucasus, whatever, we will see more and more people seeking to appropriate those messages. And in that respect, actually, again, the danger of going for big events is you might well find that they've been appropriated. In many ways, internationally speaking, the insurgents have already appropriated Sochi by making it basically the terrorism games. Well, what happens when people start being able to do that in terms of the domestic narrative too? Mm. That's going to be very, very problematic for the Kremlin.
Looks like an interesting political season ahead of us. And that's all, unfortunately, that we have time for today. I would like to remind you, you've been listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFRL. Joining me on the Skype line from Moscow has been co-host Mark Galliotti, a professor at New York University, an expert in Russia's security services, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. Thanks for the great discussion, Mark.
It's always fun.
It always is. I'd also like to thank our superhuman and superhumanly patient producer, Tanya Konchova, and my totally awesome colleague, Pavel Buturin, proprietor of the equally awesome Twitter feed, Russia Police Watch, which you can and should follow at Rus Police Watch. I'd also like to remind you, you could subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You can read the Power Vertical blog at rferl.org, and you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical. Join us again next week. And now, as always, I leave you with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper, Noise MC.